Session number 30109.
Any candidates? Reel 3. What was the next thing after you'd done the course?
Following Junior Command course, went back to 40 Command. That's obviously my parent unit. Gave him a bit of a problem actually arriving back, because he was this guy qualified to be a corporal, and it was actually one of the ones that was promoted within 2 or 3 weeks of the course. Sometimes you can wait quite a while. So they now had this full corporal in technically the signal strip of 40 Commander, who wasn't a signaller, he was only a radio operator. What are we going to do with him? We have to go and do a signals course. I don't want to do a signals course. Not where I want to go. So they undernarred for a short period, a couple of weeks, and there was actually a vacancy came up in the intelligence section for the unit. The corporal there was moving on. I said, well, I'll do that. And so I became the unit intelligence corporal, which is quite a different step. Officer, a sergeant, me, another corporal who's the illustrator, much older than me and far more experienced, and a couple of young Marines. And obviously the mission of the intelligence section in the unit is to provide the commanding officer and the unit at large. Northern Ireland's an obvious one for the intelligence side of things there, where you work to produce the goods on the various individual terrorists and link things together and plot things and plan things for them. In conventional warfare, it's a similar thing as extracting reports that come back from the field about enemy movements and attributes. Look, I did loads of courses there, aerial photographic interpretation. I did a tactical questioning course as an interrogator. Intelligence collection, collation, and evaluation were some of the other courses. And it used to teach an awful lot about how you can, little snippets of information from various areas, help make the bigger picture that can be of use to the military in the operation.
You sound like you found that very interesting work.
Look, it was. I was with a good bunch of blokes, to be perfectly honest. It was a very small group of us, so it had a bit of a challenge there. You know, you were given, as a junior NCO, I was given an enormous amount of responsibility and authority. When it gets to, say, briefing the commanding officer at the time, I could be expected to go and hold a brief in front of him and a whole bunch of other people, possibly even with foreign dignitaries visiting. It didn't have to be the intelligence officer, the sergeant, that went, well, you can go and do it, you're doing this one next time. And so you give a comprehensive brief, because you've got to understand the enemy forces orbits and things like that, so you've got to understand vehicle recognition, obviously the Soviets in those days, the Soviet structure, their ethos and things, and take hypothetical situations sometimes you're asked to do, and plan on likely courses of action and so on and so on. Like on my department, I did find that interesting. It wasn't just being rough, tough and terrific out in the field with your gun in your hand, it was actually making you use your brain as well. And the benefit of Northern Ireland tours would be things like, you worked in plain clothes 95% of the time with long hair and things, and out in the streets with guns tucked down the back of your trousers and stuff. I wasn't young enough to be sort of, James Bond sort of thing, but I was old enough to still get, mature enough to still get a bit of a kick out of it as well. But it was different.
Did you do a tour, a second tour? In the intelligence section?
Yeah, I did. I said we travelled a lot in those days. We did that Ireland tour. I did my juniors. By the September of that year, we went to the major Mediterranean exercise, amphib exercise. We came back in the early 76, we went to the States, another major amphib exercise at the Bicentennial, and came back from that leave in mid-late 76, went off to Northern Ireland again. And with this time, it was a country tour in South Armagh.
Tell me about that again, if you can, the area, what South Armagh's like.
Bandit country, as it was known as, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, basically, our TOR would have encountered most of County Armagh, and little bits of County Down with Newry. The unit was spread far more than it is in the Belfast environment. I was based at, obviously being unit in, I was based at Bessbrook, which is the headquarters. We had one rifle company with us there. Another rifle company was at Cross McGlen, another rifle company was at Fork Hill, and we took our 2-9 Commando battery with us in the ground roll, and they actually were based at Newry. So it was a fairly large geographical piece of real estate for a smallish number of blokes to look after.
And what are the major threats there in that environment?
Threats there were being very much deep in the heart of where people really didn't like you. I mean, and terrorist activity was, I wouldn't say running unchecked, but certainly it was more freedom of movement on their behalf. A, the border was just there, they can run away with anyway. And so incursions across the border and through the rural countryside were fairly frequent and not always resulting in a shooting or something happening, but you know damn well terrorists are moving through your real estate.
And was there more of a threat from, I think, roadside bombs? Would that be more of a threat possibly than in Belfast?
Yeah, I mean, the culvert bombs, the roadside stuff, very much so. I mean, especially if you're stupid enough to ever set up any real form of patterns of your patrols that would take place there, because someone would notice and someone would see how often maybe a patrol went by a particular point, and you know, certainly that's when the consideration would come to a culvert bomb. Would be quite simple to cause problems. And again, it comes back to like the urban environments. You know, your patrol patterns have got to be very comprehensive. You've got to work on the maps and make sure you don't use common routes. I mean, part of your patrol debrief is come back to the section when until into where I was as well to a certain extent, and the ops side, exactly where you've been. You know, down to grid references and routes taken and everything else, so we can actually plot that on a historical map. So therefore, in the patrol pattern that we're trying to achieve, you know, that we don't actually get someone sent on the same route within the next couple of days, just to prevent that pattern of activity occurring.
And in your role, are you interested in anything that the patrol will have noticed that might be different or unusual?
Look, loads of stuff. Innocuous conversations that the guys on the ground would have with motorists that stop in vehicle checkpoints. I mean, whilst I said you were sort of like deep in bandit country, don't get me wrong, a lot of locals would actually still talk to you. There wasn't as much abuse as in fact as you got in Belfast, but you knew that they were talking to you and smiling and being friendly, whereas also in the back of the head they also knew other things that were happening. So conversations guys could have in that situation, playing them along a little bit, you could actually find amazing little bits of information out about who was doing what and where. Not direct sort of telling you, oh, there's terrorists down the way, but you could find little things out that way.
I take it that you will be aware of the main sort of players in the area?
Yeah, I mean you've got your A list and your B lists of the ones you really want, and some of them up there are extremely well-known individuals. You even know where they live. Trouble is, you can't touch them unless you've actually got something against them committing a terrorist act. But you know who your main players are.
And would you keep information on them, or would you keep a board of detail?
Bit of both. You know, I mean, 76 is still pretty much pre-computers, so you're talking about sort of manual record keeping and little note cards kept on various individuals, which you find out. We had a one wall of the INT office, which was basically a spider web. Main ones being the A list at the top, the ones we knew, or the ones we were targeting anyway. And then really derive links down from that, who they were married to, who their brothers and sisters were, and you work your way down. And when within the spider web, you found evidence of other individuals that were known to the authorities or suspected of being responsible for and so on and so forth, you obviously highlighted them differently, so you could sort of try to see if you could find any common threads and links. Reading the newspapers, spend half the morning reading the newspapers to begin with, the local papers, reading the death columns, the marriage columns, all the rest of it, because the daft thing was some of these guys that were involved with the IRA would happily rock up at sort of, you know, the younger sister's wedding sort of routine, and the whole clan's there, and of course you've got the new in-law now part of it, and when you find the new in-law's uncle actually knows this bloke very well, and all the sort of links started coming in, and you suddenly find new faces appear that go, well, hang on, here's the bloke that maybe the guys took a photograph up on a checkpoint somewhere. Well, he was the bloke with that vehicle there that we were worried about, and now you can start to link in maybe where there's a family connection, and perhaps he was doing a courier job or something for them.
Did family play a big part in that, that area?
Yeah, I think so. You know, look, my grandma used to say, she's from the south, mind you, and she'd say, was it Twixt Carrick Macross and Closh McGlen were there more rogues than honest men? which used to upset my granddad because he was from Newry. Yeah, look, I think family. My grandma was still alive when I was doing that tour, and one of my uncles, one of my granddad's brothers, it would have been, so you're not really my uncle, but you follow where I am, tragically died. And I would have known him as a kid, I would have met him. And my grandma, bless her, just didn't really understand how I couldn't just drift down to the funeral. Like, sorry, the paper knew it was on. And, you know, we're talking to my dad, and he said, you know, your nan's really quite upset you can't go to the funeral. I said, I can't go to the funeral because I also happen to know some of the other ones that are going to the funeral are actually involved on the fringes of the whole bloody thing. So, yeah, family plays an important part. And to the extent, like I say, weddings, funerals, known members of organisations will take the opportunity to come.
And photography, would it be a routine thing to photograph at checkpoints and people who you saw?
I think if you've got, we used to use vehicle checkpoints quite often as covers for doing other things, because it's relatively easy to do. You get all the guys in uniform, you rock up and park the Land Rovers, the guys get out with the guns, and there's, you know, checking vehicles and just a routine thing. The reality of the actual patrol task might actually be that there's a couple other guys with that VCP who are actually specifically taking photographs. A, they might have some hard information about a vehicle they want to check that's coming through and who's in it, but they don't want to give it away. Or it might be because it's deliberately placed just down the way from a house they actually really want to take photographs of or gather some mint on. So that's the sort of thing, I mean, when you're saying taking photographs, yeah, we do that as a specific mission. I did one because we actually got one of the other courses I did, a video operator, and I'm talking the days with reel-to-reel tape rather than, and we had all this training down at Beaconsfield, which is very good, and got given a mission to go out to Camlock towards the back end of that tour. There was a major rally going to take place, and they knew two of the known players from down south were going to be there. And whilst they weren't prepared to break up this rally that was going to take place, they wanted some hard evidence they'd been there. They wanted to be able to know that with a much wide mobile cordon that was going to be in after they'd got there, in the hope they could possibly grab them on the way out, but at least if nothing else they'd have some new evidence. And we got tasked to take your video camera and go and stake it out basically, and film it. So we got dropped off by helicopter the back end of a normal foot patrol. I'm none of the civvies now, we're back to playing real games. Tromped off to these fields and hedgerows and God knows where, to the point that the previous point we knew, I mean, these guys went that way down the lane, me and Russ and the other lad, it was just the three of us, we should just half turn right and straight into this bloody hedgerow, crawl right, I mean big blackthorn hedge, crawl right in the middle of this damn thing, so clear ourselves a bit of an area. It's the middle of the night, obviously, clear a bit of an area, and set the camera up, which had a lens the size, half the size of a dustbin on it. It was an enormous lens, it really was, because we'd have been 200-300 metres from the city, or the town square, and set it all up on a GPMG tripod, so it was all there ready to film. We got a line of sight, we knew the farmhouse that was like 100 metres from us, we knew there were no dogs there, all this racket had been done beforehand. So we felt fairly safe and stayed there for 3 days, eating cold rations and shit in bags and all the other things you do on a long term ops. But yeah, the rally happened, and yeah, we got pictures and all the rest of it. And then someone decided to set fire to the hedgerows nearby and realised, oops, they hadn't actually seen us. It was someone that, it was a common occurrence out there. They got half a chance, and they thought there was something might be a bit up. They would actually set fire to hedgerows and things. It looked like it was the one that not that we were in, but the one across the way. But it was pretty much enough of a clue that might just be some further action going to take place. And it was late afternoon. We'd done the job really by then, so we could pretty much afford to get out and get the helicopter into the RV and pick them up and go. Interesting, yeah.
You said you just in civvies. What was and that you had longish hair? Was that Was that for, what type of operations was that for? What would you do?
Mainly so that we, if we could equally go out in unmarked vehicles, cars, in the broad community itself. And he didn't really, I mean, he weren't getting out and going around and talking to people particularly, occasionally, but not that often. More really, so you merge as a non-military vehicle in amongst general traffic, say through Newry on the road up to Belfast or wherever it might be, which you could quite easily do, and there's no reason why you're going to stand out, and observe things that are happening. I mean, the border with the south, obviously just south of Newry there, the checkpoint there was a fairly comprehensive one coming into the country. And you'd get target vehicles that would be coming up from Dundalk, where we knew most of the players lived anyway. So there'd be target registrations of vehicles that they believed were coming into the country. And again, there's no point stopping them at the border. You'd rather see a little bit where we're going. I followed one truck all the way to Belfast. It came over actually a country road across the border, back way in. But we actually had information it was coming, and sure enough it did. And the guys sort of picked up, and then we picked them up from that in the car and basically trailed it all the way to Belfast. Got a little bit worried when he drove down my Stormont with the thing and parked up for a while, because the actual vehicle was full of explosive. But once we got up there, he actually moved on, and we handed over then to other guys in the city who were doing the same job, and they eventually found it, eventually got stopped and never went bang. But yeah, it was interesting.
Where would you say sources of information, but where would that come from? Where would your bits of intelligence come from?
Look, it comes from all sources. Some of it you derive yourself, as I said, reading newspapers, hearing things, whatever it might be. Patiently, there are people in Northern Ireland who are happy to tell the authorities certain bits of information. We'd sometimes get that directly through any contacts that we ourselves might make. Other bits are made through the police, maybe come and let us know that one of their informants has told them something. So there are a variety of sources, and obviously some of these people really seriously didn't believe in the way that the events were going and wanted to do something about it, but basically were too scared to do it on their own. But you hardly blame them for it.
The end of that tour, what was the next stage for you?
God. So we got the back end of 76. More leave, I think. I got some leave. That was good. 76. Ah, yes. Well, actually, the CO had managed to fight the back end of that particular tour for me by not having me drafted to a Royal Naval frigate as part of the Royal Marines detachment, because I was due. Everyone's supposed to do sea service in their career, and my chick kept coming through saying he's got to go on this one, he's got to go on this one, and the boss had said, he's not going, he's too valuable to be doing this. So it was once we'd had the leave and Christmas of 76 was out of the way, the next inevitable one said, he's going to this ship. And I said, sir, I don't want to go to this ship. And he said, can't do it, I can't fight your corner for you. Excuse me, you got away with enough, you're going to have to go and do it, you'll have a good time. Thank you, Colonel Thompson, sir, yes. So yeah, I went to a ship and I went to do pre-embarkation training at Poole. In sort of February or so of 77, that would have been, I suppose. Joined HMS Mohawk as part of a 22-man Royal Marines detachment as one of the two corporals on board, and proceeded to spend the next, when did they come off it? Probably June, July 78, I would say, and had actually probably one of the best times of my life.
What did it involve with as a ship's detachment? What do you do on board, really?
In those days, when the detachments were that size on board naval frigates, which also were more manpower heavy in those days as well, you actually replaced 22 seamen as far as the Navy was concerned. So consequently, on board ship, you're expected to take their place and perform comparable duties. The detachments carried, obviously, for commando-style raids if it was needed, or more likely elements of crowd control and insurgency in little places like West Indian Islands and such like. There's this sort of object of the exercise. I was lucky. I mean, as one of the two corporals on the detachment, the other one was a drill instructor, and he had no great difficulty looking after a bunch of the guys doing the chipping and painting and cleaning around the upper deck of the ship, that sort of thing. And he said, no, he was happy to run that. That was fine. You know, he had a mixture of Marines and Navy guys who worked for him basically doing that. That was fine. And that left the other option, which was the inflatable boats that we use, the Gemini. that's got a corporal and a marine and a naval stoker, basically, should be looking after those things. So I thought, oh, this is good. So I actually got thoroughly into this, and I got my little rubber Gemini boats and Johnson outboard motors maintained, and every time we would anchor or moor somewhere, there was an opportunity to take the boat away. Got to go and test it, sir. Okay, and we could disappear off around the headland and find the nudist beach or where the ice cream was being sold on the beach and things like this while they're all back on board ship. It's good fun.
So did you travel around the world?
Yes, more or less. We travelled very extensively. We no sooner joined the ship than she sailed for NATO Naval On-Call Force Mediterranean, NAVIC 4 Med as it's called. And that's that would be a good 2 to 3 months around the Med. A day in here, 4 days at sea, another day in here, somewhere all the way around the Mediterranean. And as a NATO force, there'd be a Royal Naval ship, and there would be an American and a Turkish and a Greek, although they didn't always join up because we weren't allowed to, an Italian ship. And so the same bunch of ships all the way through. And so, well, you know, when you go into Naples, the self-same ships are moored. And as you get on into that tour, you start to meet guys on the other ships within the nationalities. They're mostly good blokes. And so you get them sort of, well, this is Naples, this is where I'm from, off the Italian ship, and they take you and show you things. And that was pretty good routine, to be honest. I mean, if you're in for 4 days... it's great because you work on 1 in 4 watch effectively while alongside. So one day you're going to be on watch, but the other 3 days you're going to have time to go and sightsee. So we used to go and sort of generally the attachment would take one day to go and do one of the organised tours to see something, you know, the Colosseum or whatever it might be. Another day to go and get the rabbits, you know, rabbits are souvenirs for back home and this sort of thing. And the other day get pissed. Be a good run.
So when you came back from that, I take it you were in a different position again then, because obviously you weren't with a commando because you'd been doing the detachment. So did you have to specialise at that point, or did you have to train to do something else?
I was rapidly drifting towards the point after all that time on board ship of not quite still having a direction. I was still a general duties or rifleman or rifle section corporal, and not having specialised as would have been now being a what they call about 2.5 years starts to be a bit of a worry to them. So there was starting a little bit of a pressure about what I wanted to do, and I actually just really went back and said, well, look, I said all along at the start I wanted to try and be in the aviation side, so you know, that's still what I'd like to do. But you're not a sergeant. I said, I'm not a sergeant, so you know, I'm biding my time. I don't want to get stuck into another specialist qualification that might somehow prevent me then from going and do that if I can do it. And so they sort of agreed with me there. And I had some thoughts at the time at the end of the ship, because the officer was very good, an SBS officer we had who was our boss, and he knew of my work and everything else as well. And he was actually quite keen to get me to leave the Corps and go and join some other people across the South Bank here. But that didn't happen, so that's probably just as well, I think, on retrospect. So we're sort of in this devil and deep blue sea period, I must be honest. And it really, went back to 40 Commando at the end of the ship, and within probably a couple of months, so this is the back end of 78. Yes, it would have been the autumn, early winter of 78. I actually got told I was going on a senior command course. So I actually went back at Limpston again for another 9 weeks of doing senior command training, which is like really the mirror image of doing junior command training, but the next... at the next stage up. Finished that.
Would that have helped to your ideal of
aviation?
Aviation?
Yes, very much so, because at least this was... he was the one sort of stumbling block, if you like, which was the needing to be... to be a pilot, anyway, you needed to be a sergeant, for instance. So there was something I would have to cross, and the fact I was getting a chance to cross it sooner was really just going to aid me... at least being able to try and pursue that then. And certainly as a sergeant without a specialist qualification, you would have started getting more pressure about what you wanted to do.
So what was the next stage at that?
Next stage was actually, believe it or not, was going back to Northern Ireland in the start of 79 as a corporal qualified sergeant, not actually yet promoted, in Alpha Company now, different company completely, but obviously as a rifle section corporal, getting ready for a Northern Ireland tour, which was going to be a year-long tour up in Ballycully in the north of Northern Ireland. Something's going to be different again. And that was good. That was quite interesting because, I mean, I got to be in number one section commander, number one troop alpha company, 40 commander, the senior section, the senior company, and all the rest of the nonsense. But it's a little bit of pride goes in that, so that was quite nice. And the guy who was the troop sergeant had been on the same command course I had. He just got promoted straight away. He's much older. And the boss thought this was great. He actually, in effect, had two sergeants in one troop. And thought that was really good. And partway through that tour, the start of that tour, the other guy moved on and they went promoted, you're the sergeant. Really no sooner done that though, and the company commander I was with at this point with Alpha was actually also a pilot, which was rather nice because he knew of my ambitions and he certainly aided me getting the selection testing to go place. And I managed to go back to UK for the selection testing period to fail it, be told I wasn't good enough by the RAF to be a pilot, but you're good enough to be a crewman, and said, oh, I'll probably want to do that then. Well, okay, well, I'll come in due course, that's up to the Marines sort of thing. Sent me back out to Northern Ireland, got back out to Northern Ireland, told them what had happened, and he said, don't worry about it, you'll make a bloody good crewman, and the chances are you can go that way through the apprenticeship, you'll make a good pilot eventually. Came back in the April, got married, and then went on my crewman's course in the May.
What did that involve, the crewman's course?
Yeah, that was a bit of an eye-opener. Effectively, it's done with the Army Air Corps Centre in Middle Wallop. I mean, obviously, all normally in aviation, in those days anyway, was under the auspices of Army flying as opposed to RAF or Navy flying. They've effectively got to A, teach you enough about the aircraft, its systems, how it operates, enough principles of flight, aerodynamics, all these various things. A lot of ground school, as they call it. Obviously, ability to map, read, and navigate plays a critical part of what you're doing. And in effect, I suppose, you're passing out at the end of that course is doing a very intense, tactical sortie with the aircraft, whilst comprehensively map reading stroke navigating that aircraft to make it go where it's supposed to go all the way through, giving a running commentary while you're at it. It's actually quite hard. It's like taking a motor vehicle and putting it about 40 feet above the ground and driving at, you know, 120 miles an hour and actually keep up with yourself and be able to talk about what's coming up and do it and watch aircraft systems and react to situations and so on and so forth. All the radio work did come in. The RO bit was good. It actually did help a lot. And they teach you basically how to fly the aircraft as well, because obviously the pilot's incapacitated in those days, and certainly you need to be capable of at least recovering the machine or flying to a safe location, and if you walked away it was a success. Yeah, that was interesting as well.
Is that a helicopter that you...
Yes, on the crewman's course they don't bother with basic fixed wing, they're straight into the helicopters. In my case it was either Western Scouts or Gazelles, because when I did the course they trained you on both. So you did lots of hours on both types of aircraft. And I'm trying to remember how long the course was. It's about a 3 or 4 month course, if I remember rightly.
How easy is it to fly a helicopter?
Flying helicopters is... I reckon I could pretty much teach anyone who can drive a car. I mean, it's not really that hard. Inevitably, you're going to find someone who just lacks that absolute element of coordination. But in real terms, both hands and both feet are actually always working, but independently of one another. And if, I suppose if you can't do those things, then you'll never do it. But I reckon it's not that difficult.